Well, thank you, everyone, and it's a pleasure to be here. And this is an interesting setup. This is my first time trying to do a talk exactly with this sort of setup, so it's a bit experimental, but it should be fun. I'll ask the organizers to please mute the microphone in the other room because I'm getting echo of my own voice, and that'll cause my own voice eventually to break up. There we go. That's better. And I'm assuming you can still hear me. If somebody in the crowd can go, and that'll make me reassure. Ah, yeah, I can see the waving there in the background. Excellent. So the title of my talk is How I Know What I Know About the Web, and we'll go to the first slide now. The first slide is blank. I've left it deliberately blank because this is the slide where I make the claim that I, in fact, know stuff about the web. This is kind of a presupposition that we're making as I give this talk, that I do, in fact, know stuff about the web. I may know a lot about the web. I may know a little about the web. That may be the subject of dispute and conjecture. But I want to take the attitude with this talk that what I'm presenting here is not an argument for a particular approach to research or anything like that, but rather something more like a description or an explanation of the thinking that I've gone through and the process that I've gone through in determining how I approach my own research on the web. Now, I will say, and this is for the record, because you know, there's recordings being made of this talk, that I have some credentials as a researcher and a scientist. I'm employed by the National Research Council of Canada, employed as a researcher here, and therefore I am what they call a scientist. And I have proof of that because if you look out there on the internet, if you look up the Luxuriant Hair Club for Scientists, you'll find that I am a member. I'm a member by virtue not merely of my hair, but also by virtue of being recognized as a scientist. And so we'll work from that presumption. As we come to the end of the talk, we can talk about what happens when that presumption is disputed and how that is resolved. But for now, I'm just going to take it for granted that that's the perspective that I'm working from. So we'll move to the next slide. Back when I was a naive undergrad, I probably shouldn't say it that way, but and having read lots of science fiction books, I used to have the idea that science and knowledge and learning and research are obtained from induction. And the idea was that you would go out, you would have experiences of the world, and then these experiences of the world would gradually accumulate over time and would lead you to believe general truths about the world. John Stuart Mill's methods of induction is a system of this type, and Mill himself said that induction, or general principles, are essentially shorthand for the sum of the experiences that we have. In the 20th century, and in the logical positivist movement that came to dominate philosophy and the philosophy of science, we have people like Carl Hempel formalizing this in the deductive nominological method, the DN model. And the idea here is, again, that we have observations which are codified into observation statements, and these observation statements lead us to, through a process of induction, general principles about the world. Now, this, as it turns out, is not an adequate picture of the sciences, and there are a number of reasons for this, but the things that the positivists ran into right off the bat, first of all, the problem of induction, the problem that your inductive conclusion, your general principle, does not follow logically from your observations, and then secondly, the problem of confirmation. Problem of induction is an age-old problem. I first encountered it reading David Hume, and essentially the problem is this. Future experiences are logically separate from present or past experiences, and therefore past or present experiences cannot lead to conclusions about future experiences. They're logically separate from each other, and therefore no matter what happened in the past, logically the future might be different. Well, general principles are intended to predict the future. But logically, these general principles could be false in the future. The second problem is the problem of confirmation. The idea of Hempel's DN model was that you come up with this general principle, you use it to predict the future, and then if the prediction comes true, great. Now you have what is called confirming evidence for your prediction. And that's a model that's probably very familiar to most people. It's a model that is represented as typical in sciences. The problem is, pretty much anything confirms an instance of a theory. If you take a theory that predicts a proposition P, the proposition P is logically equivalent to the proposition P or Q, which is equivalent to the proposition, if not P, then Q. What this means is that the confirmation of any instance Q, which might have nothing to do with your theory, is a confirming instance of your theory. So if I predict that water or gravity makes water fall, then the statement that the president of France is named Sarkozy is a confirming instance of my theory. So it's not a good theory because of that. Next slide, please. So consequently, philosophers of science, and in particular Karl Popper, moved to the idea of falsification. And falsification is something that is fundamental to science today. Falsification is the idea that the theory that you propose has to be testable, and testable not simply by confirming instances, but testable by falsification. That is to say, you make predictions that are perhaps novel or unusual with your theories, and then you go out and you attempt to falsify them. You attempt to find counterexamples. And if you are unable to find counterexamples, presumably then your theory, your general principle, is supported by the research. The problem with falsification is essentially the same as the problem with confirmation. Even if you have not falsified your theory, you do not have solid positive evidence that your theory is true. You do not have a valid argument that your theory is true. Your theory might be false even if you have never been able to falsify it, despite all of your attempts to falsify it, despite it being a falsifiable theory. So we need something more when we're looking at proving or disproving theories. But I want to, next slide please. I want to stop here for a moment and think about even the philosophy of science as we've gotten to this point, because a lot of the research that we do even today is based on these principles of confirmation and falsification. And as a consequence, a lot of the research is liable to fall into a category of fallacies known as inductive fallacies. And how do I say this delicately? It seems to me that much of the research that I read in journals falls into one of these categories. For example, a fallacy known as hasty generalization. This is a fallacy of induction where you are arriving at a generalization based on too few instances. There are numerous research articles that I read out there that are based on very small samples. And I know that there were arguments back and forth that say, well, the small sample is okay and all of that. But from where I sit, a sample of 14 people, a sample of 24 people is not going to be sufficient to establish a generalization. It only establishes a statement about that very small group of people. Samples, if we're going to make generalizations about people as a whole, humans as a whole, we need samples that are much larger than, say, your class of undergraduates. The second fallacy is the unrepresentative fallacy. And again, this is something that I see represented frequently in the literature. A sample is unrepresentative if it does not have the same sort of constitution as the population as a whole. If the population as a whole is 50% men and 50% women, and your sample is 100% men, then it is unrepresentative. Now, what this means is that a lot of the research that is published out there that is composed of, say, 24 American students in a graduate class in psychology or whatever is very unrepresentative. It's unrepresentative because it represents a certain class of people, that class of people that's able to afford to go to university. It represents a certain class of people, that class of people that is American. And therefore, conclusions drawn on the basis of those samples are not generalizable. Next slide, please. Other fallacies, inductive fallacies that we see from time to time, false analogy, where two objects or events being compared are relevantly dissimilar. I don't want to linger too much on that fallacy, although this is the sort of thing that comes up fairly frequently. And then finally, fallacy of exclusion. This is what Rudolf Carnap called the requirement of the total evidence. The fallacy of exclusion occurs when you exclude evidence that might change the outcome of your inference. And so when you're picking very carefully to make sure you have just the right kind of sample, you're liable to engage in this fallacy if you're picking the sample that will make your conclusion come true. Now, I don't want to say everybody does this all of the time, but I think that if we sat down and we looked and we listed through the research articles that are present in our journals, we'd find very small samples, we'd find unrepresentative samples, we'd find relevant information not included in our sampling process. Next slide, please. The other thing that has dogged positivism and inductivist research methods is what has come to be called theory-laden data. And there are various origins for this, and I'll draw from Willard Van Orman Quine, his very important paper, Two Dogmas of Empiricism. And the idea here that the positivists had was that there is a very clear separation to be made between observations or observation statements and theoretical statements, or as the slide says, analytic and synthetic. The idea here is that we can make theory neutral statements about what we see. The grass is green, the sky is blue, this is a cat. The problem is that our vocabulary that we use to describe the world embodies the theory of the world that we have. Some examples from the history of science make this fairly clear. Scientists used to believe that fires emit phlogiston. And so there was the phlogiston theory of combustion. And people thought when they were observing fires that they were observing phlogiston. Phlogiston does not exist. The language that was used misrepresented, or as we would say today, the language misrepresented what was actually happening. But the thing is, when people were conducting experiments back then, they were using that language. Their observations were based on their theories about fire. Similarly, pre-Copernican theories about the revolution of the planets, one of the things that people said that they observed is they observed the planets going through epicycles. When a planet goes through the sky in orbit, the planet doesn't go through the sky in a nice neat line. If you're plotting it day after day, it sort of makes little loops. And these little loops are epicycles. And so they thought that the planets were going in little loops and they would describe the epicycles. And again, what was happening here is the descriptions of the motions of the planets were being made in the language of the theory that applied. Consequently, according to Quine and according to other critics, you do not have theory-neutral statements. You do not have pure statements of observation. And to me, this is a fundamental thing it's a fundamental concern of mine. When I read scientific research papers, I read a lot of theory, even in the observation statements. One of the things we deal with, for example, in education, we deal with things like how people learn, how they come to believe what they believe, how they know what they know. Now, terms like believe and know and feel and etc. form a vocabulary of what is called in the philosophy of mind folk psychology. Folk psychology basically is a psychology that would be held by common folk over the years. Now, if you have a theory of psychology, a theory of learning that is not based on folk psychology, for example, Paul Churchland's theory of eliminative materialism, then there is literally no such thing as a belief. There is literally no such thing as knowledge. These words that we use are not the words, are not the things that are actually happening. So we hit a conundrum here, right? We're out there, we're doing experiments, we're doing research. The questions we ask, we're asking, well, what is the belief that the student arrives at? What is the learning that the student arrives at? But the very questions presuppose that some sort of folk psychological theory is true. Next slide, please. Now, you've all heard of Thomas Kuhn, and Thomas Kuhn fits into the progression of history in this way. He's most famous, of course, for his work, Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and the idea here of a scientific revolution is that in a science, science proceeds through what they call normal science. People go out, they do experiments, they do measurements, science progresses nicely, neatly, and orderly. But then, over time, there becomes more and more of a dissonance inside that scientific paradigm, more and more unresolved problems, more and more contradictions. And then what happens, says Kuhn, is that there is a deep structural change in our view of the world. We have what is known as a scientific revolution. The classic example of that is the Copernican Revolution, where we originally believed in the Ptolemaic world that the Earth was the center of the universe and everything revolved around it. And then we had a revolution and we came to believe that the Sun was the center of the solar system and the Earth and everything else revolve around the Sun. Our actual view of the world changed. Now, what's important about Kuhn is not simply that we have these revolutions, because we can have a story where each revolution is getting us closer and closer and closer to the truth, and that's okay. But what's important is that these theories, the past theory that scientists had and the present theory that scientists have now, are what Kuhn said are incommensurable with each other. Now, what that means is quite literally the vocabulary that is used in the previous theory is not comprehensible, is not understandable by the people who hold the current theory. So we see this theory-ladenness of the data coming into play again, right? The vocabulary that the previous theory used describes the world according to that theory. But that vocabulary can't be used in research about the present theory because it would make no sense to do so. Next slide, please. Larry Lawden is important because what he does now is he talks about the goal of science as not to, as we all thought, to find out about the nature of the world. Now we're sort of rethinking this because there's a certain and important sense in which science isn't about the nature of the world. If science is about the nature of the world, then it wouldn't be so bound in theory. It wouldn't be so bound in the language. Science, according to Larry Lawden, is intended to solve problems. Theories matter. Theories are relevant. Theories are used in only insofar as they solve problems. And it doesn't matter even if the theory is wrong, literally wrong, right? So long as the theory solves a problem. A good example of that is Newtonian mechanics. Newtonian mechanics is technically false. It's superseded by relativity. But Newtonian mechanics works to build a bridge, to build a building. We can use Newtonian mechanics, we can solve problems with Newtonian mechanics, and that's sufficient. But what's happened here now is we've separated the purpose of theorizing, the purpose of research, and we've separated it from the object of research, and now the purpose of research is directed toward something else, that is directed toward another objective than simply knowing what the world is about. It's directed toward addressing needs of everyday life. Next slide, please. And that leads naturally to what is probably a big part of everyone's reality, certainly a big part of my reality, the idea of the research program. And this is sketched in detail by Imre Lakatos. And the idea here is that the theory that we're talking about, whether it be quantum mechanics, relativity, whatever, is a set of propositions that shares a common idea, but it's not defined as a particular set of propositions. It's not defined as a particular set of truths about the world, but rather it's defined as propositions that revolve around the common theme, revolve around the common idea. And so you can actually have inside a research program contradictory propositions, mutually exclusive propositions. You see in the research program aspects of debate, aspects of conflict. A research program might be, for example, learning styles research, to pick a topical example. And you have all kinds of people who are investigating learning styles, and you have a large amount of funding for learning styles. But that doesn't mean that there is a single set of proposition, A, B, C, D, E, that is the theory of learning styles. Rather, you have this set of mutually inconsistent, sort of revolving around the same idea kind of approaches or theories. So you have Kolb and all of the others that address the same sort of idea. And what characterizes success in the research program model is not that they get it right. It's not that they somehow represent truth in the world, but rather it's characterized by the growth of the research program. Is it attracting more researchers? The discovery of new things, new ways of doing things, the discovery of new experimental procedures, experimental techniques, discovery of better predictions, or the making of better predictions. It's, in other words, we can characterize a robust research program according to this set of criteria. This set of criteria is going to change over time depending on what the purpose of the research program is, what the expected outcome of the research program is. From the perspective of science being about finding, the nature of the world, this all sounds a bit circular. And outside the research program, you look at the research program from outside the research program, and you're inclined to say, well, there's no connection between the research program and the world. And this is the sort of criticism that gets made of, well, learning styles. People look at learning styles and they say, well, yeah, there's all this research program here, but it doesn't match up with this other description of the world. But the thing is, in a research program, you don't expect that to happen. The research program is its own justification for success. Next slide, please. All this leads to, if you will, a shift in what it is that we're trying to do when we're trying to do research. I talked about trying to find generalizations about the world, trying to find truths about the world. Today, I think it's largely accepted that what we're up to is trying to find scientific explanations to explain why such and such happens. This is an idea that has its origins in Benjamin Franklin Pierce, the theory of abduction, or as it's also known as, the inference to the best explanation. Now, what is the best explanation? We can talk about that, but we have different kinds of explanation, different models of explanation. I mentioned a couple here, statistical relevance or causal mechanical, and these are just ways of generating explanations that explain why something happens. Next slide, please. Now, the thing with explanation, the thing with inferences to the best explanation is we've got this separation now from from the correspondence between the theory and facts of matter in facts of the matter in the world. And so what we have basically now are what might be called a set of methodological principles that govern our selection of explanations. For example, just to give you a quick one, we tend to prefer explanations that are simple rather than explanations that are complicated. It's not because we have some sort of unique insight and that we know the world is simple, but rather it's a general methodological principle known as Occam's razor, that we prefer simple explanations. We do not, as Occam says, multiply entities beyond necessity. Now, this principle could be wrong. There's no reason why there might be unnecessary entities in the world. It's entirely possible. But as a methodological principle, it's easier and more productive if we go after the simplest explanation. With that said, now, we move into the idea that, okay, we have a bunch of phenomena, every grade 6 student is over 8 feet tall, whatever. And what we're up to in research, so goes the theory, is that we're trying to explain this phenomenon. So we can see now in this process some fallacies of explanation. You should be on the fallacies of explanation one slide. First and most common fallacy that I see in explanation is, falls under the heading of subverted support. The phenomenon being explained simply doesn't exist. And indeed, what I find, more so in political writing than in scientific writing, but I see this a lot, people structure their statements in such a way as to be trying to explain things and using this explanation as a way of getting people to believe that the thing actually exists. For example, somebody might say, the reason why people are always trying to advance their own interests in the marketplace is that they think that the marketplace will serve their interests best. Now, that's an explanation. That explanation is explaining why people try to serve their own interests first in the marketplace. Now, the presumption there is that it is true that people are trying to serve their own interests best in the marketplace. But very often, when I read an explanation of this sort, the statement that they're trying to prove, or it's trying to explain, people try to serve themselves first in the marketplace, is not, in fact, true. It's certainly not true as a universal statement, and is frequently not true even as a statistical generalization. A related fallacy of explanation is what is called non-support. The statement that is being explained, such as, for example, people always try to serve their own interests in the marketplace, this statement doesn't appear out of nowhere, right? Usually the statement is a statement that is obtained inductively. It is a statement that is obtained by going out and looking at the world and seeing what things hold, what things are true. If an inductive fallacy has been committed in the creation of this statement, then an instance of the fallacy of non-support occurs in the explanation. If, for example, you go out and you survey 12 American graduate students, and they all say, oh yes, we loved this course, and then you write, the reason why they love this course is blah, 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 blah. That is an instance of this fallacy. The thing that you are trying to explain has not been supported properly. It has been supported through fallacious reasoning. The next fallacy of explanation is untestability, and this is something that comes from Popper. It comes from the HD model, the idea that our explanation needs to be able to be tested. Our explanation needs to apply to more than just the thing that's being explained. The classic example of this comes from Aristotle, criticisms of Aristotle. Ask Aristotle, why does a rock fall when you drop it? And Aristotle will say, well, it's in the nature of the rock to fall. That's what rocks do. Well, that sounds like a great explanation, but how do you test it? There's no way to test it. There's no way to find a rock that doesn't have rockness as a nature. There's no way to find a rock that doesn't fall. So there's, you know, Aristotle's explanation is empty. There's nothing there, nothing that could ever be found that would show that Aristotle's explanation is false. If you can't test the explanation, then the explanation, in an important sense, does not actually explain anything. Next slide, please. And these next two fallacies look at this in a bit more detail. Limited scope, limited depth. Limited scope is the explanation only explains one thing. Generally, again, as a methodological principle, we want explanations that are wide-ranging. Well, we want explanations that explain many things, not just the thing that we're looking at here. If you're studying learning, for example, an explanation that explains why American graduate students do such and such is a very narrow explanation. It's not very useful. We want an explanation that will talk preferably about people, not about American graduate students. Similarly, limited depth. It's an explanation that does not appeal to underlying principles. And I can get bogged down in this whole conversation about what constitutes an underlying principle and whether we even need them. But the thing is, if the explanation is simply a repetition of the description of the thing that we are trying to explain, it is very shallow. Something like that is so shallow, it's circular. If it does not get beyond immediate experiences, if it does not expose some underlying, I would say regularity or similarity or pattern in the environment, then the explanation is what we would call shallow. And again, we would say the explanation does not actually explain things. In science, in the philosophy of science, the limited depth principle is intended to hold our explanations to a requirement that they appeal to some cause, that X causes Y, that in general, things that are of type X cause type Y. And the more underlying, the more broad these causal principles are, the more we are told that we have a good explanation. Next slide, please. But the thing is, science, if it becomes a question of explaining, now becomes even more theory-bound than it was before. If you read Bas van Frassen's The Scientific Image, van Frassen says, science is intended to answer why question. But the why question is not simply, you know, why is the sky blue? The why question is why something rather than something else? Why is the sky blue rather than red? Why is the sky blue rather than clear? Why is the sky blue rather than there being no sky? Depending on what our different expectations were, we have different explanations of the phenomenon. Our expectations form a part of our explanation. Nor would Russell Hansen, Patterns of Discovery, makes this very clear when he talks about the different causes of a motor accident. The cause of a motor accident might be the shrubbery. Well, so would say the urban designer. The cause of a motor accident might be the fact that the brakes failed. So would say the mechanic. The cause of the motor accident might be the drunk driver. So would say the police officer. You see, what your expectations are, what your perspective is, changes your story about what the cause of something is. It changes what your explanation is. We have this presupposition coming into our scientific investigation. We have this presupposition that exists in the very statement of the questions that we ask. Heidegger talks about when we ask a question, we're not just asking what is the phenomenon, but we're asking the question of someone, and we're asking the question, we expect a certain type of thing in response. Next slide, please. What we believe, and I use that language carefully, is revealed in our questions. It's revealed in our experimentations. It's revealed in the process of research that we take as a whole. What we believe is revealed in our actions. And it's revealed not just in our actions, but in our language and in our experimentation. We should look at Derrida, for example, the practice of deconstruction. What we believe is revealed in our language. I won't linger on this because I don't have a whole lot of time, but if you look at language, look at the way we express tense in the language. I am, I will be, I could be, I was, I want to be. These things that we express in language express possible states of being. And the expression of these possible states of being express what I believe are the possible states of being. So even in a simple statement like, I am embodying or incorporating through the simple use of those terms, a theory, a view of what the world is. Next slide, please. On top of that, and concordant with all of this, is the issue of complexity. Now, in our domain especially, the sorts of things that we are looking at are complex entities. They're people. They're students. Originally, science looked at and thought of the world as though it were a set of billiard balls. One thing causes another, causes another, causes another. And, you know, maybe it would be complicated. Two things might cause one thing, or one thing might cause two things, but it was all very neat, very linear, very orderly, very predictable. If we knew everything, if we knew enough, we could predict the outcomes of things. But the problem is, the systems that we work with are complex systems. We are not looking at single variables. We cannot isolate single variables to measure because the variables are mutually dependent. In a paper I wrote once, imagine trying to test the impact of lowering the interest rates in Grand Prairie. Grand Prairie is a city in northwestern Canada. Well, the problem is lowering the interest rates in Grand Prairie does not lower the interest rates in Dawson Creek. We hold that stable. Well, okay, what about lowering the interest rates in Dawson Creek? Well, that's not really what I meant. What happens here is you try to change one variable, and it means another variable that impacts the first variable becomes significant. So you try to hold the other variable constant and change the first. And you end up in this constant cycle of changing variables, holding variables consistent. The problem is there's no way to find a neutral way of holding the variables consistent. The way you represent the other variables determines the outcome of your experiment. Again, I don't have a lot of time to go into this, but if I wanted to talk about what would happen if, that gets me into the logic of counterfactuals. The logic of counterfactuals tells me how to describe the rest of the world if I'm going to hold this variable constant. The problem is how I describe the rest of the world. Now I'm engaged in the practice of describing possible worlds. Well, there's an infinite number of possible worlds. What possible world do we choose? Do we choose the possible world on which Martians landed? Well, probably not. So the possible world we choose will be the possible world most similar, so we say, says, say, Robert Stonacher, to the world we currently inhabit. But what world is that? Well, that's the world as we see it. The possible world that defines what happens when we hold our variables constant is the world that most resembles our current theories. Consequently, even in the process of evaluating these variables, context matters. The way we see the world matters. Also on this slide, you see something, and I just made up this term, massively complex. And this is a situation that happens when the variables that are involved are beyond our capacity to describe. That there are so many variables and so many interactions between the variables that we cannot possibly describe all of those variables. Our understanding of the world goes beyond language. Now I'm getting the the little messages from Francis to wrap this up and move to questions. So what I want to say is that as a consequence of all of this, and how do I want to do this? I'm going to skip the slide that says signs and traces because that goes on the same point a little bit more. Go to personal knowledge. The idea here is that our knowledge of the world is irreducibly personal, and not just that, but it goes beyond symbols, it goes beyond language. It is, as Polanyi would say, personal, and that it's ineffable. And each of us, each one of us, is one of these personal knowledge devices. We perceive the world at some symbolic level. Next slide. That leads us to a whole non-linguistic, sub-linguistic, I would say, understanding of the world. The sub-linguistic understanding of the world that is revealed in our actions and in our behaviors. Next slide. What that means is that instead of observing the system, we can only engage in the system. Instead of going and trying to measure what we think is out there in the world, we have to involve ourselves with it. And involve not just ourselves, but the communities that are involved in whatever it is that we're studying. And I'm really skipping through a lot of points that I would have liked to have made, but I should have spent less time on the earlier slides. It's my fault. And next slide. The idea here, the principle here, is that we treat the community of people itself as the knowing agent. We think of knowing and learning, discovering, perceiving as things that can happen in communities, and so we think of the community as a sensory system. And so in order to study a discipline, what we're trying to study is this community, and we need to understand that when we're studying this community, we're not just studying the nature of the world itself. We're studying what this community senses, what this community perceives. Next slide. That gives us a process, and it gives us a methodology that I call build it and they will come. And the method basically is to build things. To build things like the connectivism course that George Siemens and I have put on, and then see how the community reacts to that. See what they say, see what they do. And also to have other people build things and see what people do when they build things. When Google launches a new browser, what happens? And the idea here is not to measure variables, not to go out and do controlled experiments, because those are just fancy ways of assuming our own conclusion, but rather to see what sort of things are happening in the world. And the way we see, next slide please, the way we see things happening in the world is that we're looking for signs, we're looking for traces, we're looking for things that reveal what it is that the people who are acting in the world believe. To know is to recognize patterns in this environment, to be able to reliably see patterns, to be able to reliably, in some cases, predict patterns. And I'm going to have to stop it there because I know I am completely out of time. So perhaps I'll stop it there and we'll see if there's any comments or questions at this point. And I hear nothing. Oh, there we go. I can't understand that. I hear you, yes. So. It's actually a return to the thing itself. I wouldn't say so. I mean, Polanyi talks about, and as I mentioned in the slide there very briefly, talks about knowing how as opposed to knowing that. He depicts knowledge as being more like a skill than an acquisition. And ineffable knowledge is, as to use one of his examples, like knowing how to ride a bicycle. It's knowledge, it's ineffable in the sense that there's no set of sentences, no set of words that can be used to describe the process of how to ride a bicycle that is equivalent to the knowledge of how to ride a bicycle. Now, this knowledge might still be false knowledge. You might falsely know how to ride a bicycle. You might be a very bad bicycle rider, say, getting into crashes all the time. But even so, whatever knowledge that is still ineffable. It still can't be generated equivalently as words and sentences. Yeah. Right. Okay. I don't think you'd build them into anything particularly, but that's a separate issue. I mean, the process of acquiring patterns is the process of experiencing. And what that is the process of embedding yourself, enmeshing yourself in and out, or in another domain, we might say, embedding yourself, enmeshing yourself in a community of practice. If you're interested in a particular domain, you would find the community that is involved in that domain. And so, basically what you're doing then is trying to, I don't want to say create or construct, because that's the wrong word, but find the network, find the sets of connections for yourself that will lead to the greatest probability of being able to recognize these patterns. Now, that in itself is a matter of network principles. It's a question of what are successful networks, what are less successful networks, what principles will lead us to more reliably predict patterns than won't predict patterns. These are methodological principles analogous to the principles of explanation that I talked about earlier. And I would say, based on my own observations, that there are four major principles that you want to adhere to, and I call these the semantic condition. Diversity. You want a diverse set of connections. You want your connections to have different origins, different points of view, different perspectives. Secondly, openness. You want your network to be open. You want to be open to new things, to new ideas, to new connections. Interactive. You want your relation with these connections to go back and forth. You want the knowledge that you build out of these, the knowledge that you grow, the knowledge that you discover. See how the vocabulary traps us. To to be the result of interactions rather than depicting it or thinking of it as the result of transfer. And autonomy. You want the members in your network to be acting autonomously, to making their own decisions, pursuing their own interests. If everybody you know works for Microsoft, that's not the world's most autonomous network out there. They're all, in a certain way, marching to Bill Gates' tune. That's not good. You want people who are coming, who are making their own decisions and doing their own things. Now, like I said, these are methodological principles. These are the ones that I've come across over the years. It's also one of the last slides, so I've gotten that into. And they might be wrong. And they're the sort of thing that, we can tell whether or not these are good principles according to whether the knowledge, the recognition, the capacity for pattern recognition proves over time to be robust, proves over time to serve our own interests and our own needs. And these principles are my principles. They may not be your principles. I'm sorry, did you say that again? Right. The short answer, a generalization will be a statement that embodies the elements of the instances that produce that generalization. For example, P1, P2, P3, P4 will lead to PN. The generalization contains the P, and that P is derived from the instances. Pattern recognition, on the other hand, the pattern that is recognized will not embody properties of the instances that lead to that pattern. Classic kind of pattern recognition is the recognition of a letter on a broken scoreboard. You've seen broken scoreboards, right? Half the lights are out. All you see is a dot here, a dot here, a dot here, a dot here. And you look at it, oh yeah, that's a six, right? You've only got four dots, but you know that that's a six. You're able to recognize the six in the dots. But the six is something distinct from the dots. The number six isn't embodied in any way in the dots. It's the organization that leads to the recognition of the pattern. Thanks a lot. Sure. Yeah, I'll be here. Thanks a lot. Hello, Steve Downs here. Hey there. Yeah, I'm